responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Federoff will address the federal budget deficit, and Environmental Protection Agency Council 238 Executive Vice President Tom Link will update listeners on the council's Save the Environment, Save the EPA campaign. But first, AFGE National Council of Social Security Administration Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski joins us to discuss the union's new agreement with SSA. Witold, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So after more than 2 years of negotiations, AFGE and SSA have reached a conceptual agreement for the terms of a new contract. Tell us what that means, conceptual, and what's part of the agreement.
Well, we agreed. We went to the Federal Services Impasses Panel in October with our dispute over 40 articles that we had not agreed on, and they sent us back to intense mediation. So we set up a schedule of mediation starting in January and running through the end of February. And during that period, we reached a breakthrough and actually started negotiating and reached last Tuesday of last week. Tuesday evening, we finally reached an agreement without writing the language. So when we say conceptual agreement, we agreed on various points issues that would be resolved in the contract. Some of it is in language. Other parts are ideas that we agreed upon that still have to be written. So when we say agreement and concept, we still have to go through the process of writing down what we agreed to.
Now, you mentioned that
contract language. I mean, we have some basic understanding of what we agreed to, but we have to translate it into contract language.
You mentioned that you had a breakthrough last week. How did you get to that point of actually being able to make some progress?
Well, one, there's a few factors that entered into that. One, I think going to the Federal Services Impasses Panel was a key thing that the union did, that they set up a schedule. They said, you know, we want something. We're going to send you back for intense mediation, but we want this done by the end of February. And if not, you know, we want you to send us jointly a list of all your disputes, and then we'll decide what to do. And we'd been led to believe they would appoint a fact finder who would basically conduct a hearing and get positions on each of the disputed issues from the parties, and then make a recommendation to the panel for them to make a decision. So the parties knew that, you know, they had a final opportunity here to just between themselves reach an agreement before third parties would enter the process. So I think that was a motivating factor. Second, John Gage, our national president, offered his assistance, and Gary Etter, the mediator from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, decided that it would help if we had some very small sessions off-site. Mr. Gage and myself and two of the management, the management chief negotiator and the head of labor relations for the SSA, met off-site on a few occasions. And basically, those meetings helped us define our positions and where we wanted to go with this contract. And the third thing, I think, Carolyn Colvin, who is the principal deputy commissioner for Social Security, she was appointed by Obama and has been in office for a couple of years. She has been behind the scenes pushing the management team to I think, get off the dime on some of their positions. And she has expressed publicly on a number of occasions the fact that she wanted the contract done and want better union management relations in SSA. So I think all those elements entered into the picture in us being able to do this.
When do you expect the workforce to ratify the contract and then have it fully implemented?
Well, we started the process. Like I said, Tuesday we reached this conceptual agreement, and then Wednesday we started trying to draft language reflecting what we agreed to, and we didn't finish. So we now are going to resume that process in the first week of April. And if we can conclude it then, which would be the best case scenario, we would have a agreement would be printed up. That would take about a week to 10 days, and then distributed to the employees for ratification votes. And each local, there's a lot of locals in SSA. There's 45 just in my council, and there's probably 20 to 25 others. Each local would conduct a ratification vote. And then assuming that that ratification vote approves the contract, then you know, we'd have a signing of it probably at the earliest in mid-June. Of course, if we don't reach agreement in the first week of April on the written product, that would all be delayed. Now, there are four articles that we set aside and agreed that we would go through the ratification process, and if the contract, and when the contract is ratified, the contract would be implemented, and then we would have a fixed time period to negotiate these other four articles, and those are big ones. Our merit promotion system, the appraisal system, and telework, work at home. And we have a small article, work at home by exception, which is the ability to work at home if you're disabled or temporarily disabled. So those are the four things that we decided, due to their complexity and the fact that we had huge differences, that perhaps that we should set them aside. We can reach it. We were able to reach agreement in concept and everything else. So after the majority of the contract goes into effect, then we would negotiate those other four articles, and we'd either agree, or if we didn't agree, we'd go through the same process we did in the big contract. We'd go to the impasses panel if we couldn't reach agreement and go through that process.
Vitold, what's the union's position on those four articles?
Well, merit promotion is really a what happened in merit promotion is in the middle of our contract, the agency unilaterally instituted an electronic merit promotion system. They got rid of all their factors and weights that they had used for years. The agency had used a combination of elements such as the length of time that you did a job, the awards that you received for your work performance, your appraisal ratings, the training and education that you have. And employees got points. It was a point system. They got points based on those various factors. And those factors were weighted for various jobs. And when people competed, when they put in their applications, those aspects of their history, work history, were scored, and best qualified lists were established. And the selecting official picked individuals for vacancies from the best qualified list. Now, SSA unilaterally changed that system, dumped all their factors and weights, and just came up with it like a test or a questionnaire. And they used the score of the test or questionnaire to assemble their well-qualified list, and the selecting official picks from there. So we filed a grievance, actually, on that, went to arbitration and won, and the arbitrator ruled that they had to go back to the previous system. And the agency appealed it, filed exceptions on it, and exceptions stay the decision. And we're still waiting for a decision on the exceptions from the FLRA. So we have a fundamental difference on how the agency does their merit promotion system. We think that the performance that an individual has had in their job, their length of service, the awards that they've received, their education and training, all are factors that should be included in deciding who makes the best qualified list for a selecting official. The agency has used this system basically to promote younger workers who have little experience and have not had the opportunity to get awards and have early in their career not achieved outstanding appraisal ratings, to allow them to be on an even standing with veteran employees, and we don't think that's right. So we have a big difference there, and they also want to narrow the areas of consideration, which is where a job is posted. Now we have like pretty much a national area of consideration where you could put in for a job anywhere in the country and have to be considered, and they want to change that and radically change it, actually, to make it very limited where you can put in for a job. And there's a lot of other differences. In the appraisal area, you know, they have a right to establish the appraisal system they want. They have a three-tiered appraisal system. And our big thing there is employees ought to know up front what they have to do to achieve various levels of the system. And they also ought to know up front how they're going to be measured, what measurement systems they're going to use, and how they'll be applied to the various elements on their appraisal. And there should be a fair way of deciding factors out of their control. It should be known by both parties that there are factors out of your control that affect your ability to achieve your the performance that is within your appraisal system. And then if somebody is not performing, they should have a fair opportunity to have a period of time when they can attempt to resume performing at an adequate level. And we think the agency's proposals really don't provide the kind of information that employees need to achieve their appraisal ratings, the kind of they don't inform them how they're going to be measured or rated, and they make it very difficult for a poor performer to achieve an adequate performance. So we think, you know, we have big problems in that area too.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Witold Skwierczynski, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, in the last segment, we were talking about some of the particulars of the contract and some things that needed to be resolved yet. Let's talk about now some of the things that were resolved. I know that you had negotiated some cash benefits for employees, including a transit subsidy for workers outside the National Capital Region, as well as some adjustments to the eyeglass program and employee rights. Could you detail some of those things for us?
Yes. With regards to the transit subsidies, currently employees in the Capital Region get up to $125 a month transit subsidy, but employees outside the Capital Region only get up to $60 a month. And we negotiated an increase for the employees outside the Capital Region. So in the first year of the contract, they would get $75. In the second year, $80. And we agreed to a four-year contract. In the fourth year, it would be $90. So that's about a 50% increase at the end of the four-year period. In the eyeglass program, these are employees who require eyeglasses because of their use of BDTs or computers, and they're certified by an ophthalmologist that their vision has deteriorated because of the use of computers, and they can now get up to $50 for the exam. And that has been increased to $65, and currently they get up to $175 for the eyeglasses themselves, and we increase that to $200. With regards to employee rights, There's a variety of provisions there that we negotiated. One is the Weingarten right. Now, that's that the Weingarten right is a right that an employee has to union representation if they have a reasonable belief that a discussion they're having with management may result in a disciplinary action. Currently, the right is in the contract, and it's listed, and the employees get a yearly notice from management. But when the discussion occurs, the employer is not required to say anything about their right. We negotiate a clause requiring now management to orally inform the employee that they have a right to a union official during this conversation because it may lead to disciplinary action. We figure that'll send out bells and whistles to the employees, and they'll ask for assistance. There's a currently memory joggers are notes that a management official can keep in observing an employee's behavior or performance that do not have to be disclosed to the employee as long as they're not disclosed to anyone and kept in a secure place. We negotiated a clause that required management to convert such secret notes to a file and provide the employee a copy within a year. Otherwise, they couldn't use those notes in any kind of adverse manner against the employee. We have a timeliness clause that we negotiated with regards to putting material in files so that if the agency is collecting work performance data or misconduct information, that they have to timely notify the employee or else it's unusable in a performance or conduct-based action. We have a new bullying clause, which is brand new, which prohibits bullying in the workforce. We think we have a foot in the door to be able to file grievances if we have management officials who engage in that kind of intimidating behavior, which has become rather widespread, in my view, not only in Social Security, but in many other government agencies. So I think those particular, we have a new clause also about formal discussions. The union has a right to be present when the agency's engaged in a formal discussion with groups of employees. Those are commonly about changes in agency policy or reiteration of agency rules. We've had a problem doing that in the electronic environment, so we have now negotiated a clause where if the agency's having an electronic conversation and they have a nationwide internal video system within Social Security where people in headquarters can communicate with all the employees in the country through video technology, we now have a right to be present in the studio, allowing us to ask questions of the official who's conducting the formal discussion and to state the union's position about whatever they're talking about, which is the kind of right you would have if they're having a discussion, a physical discussion with employees. So we thought that was an important gain in employee rights.
Vitold, you spent a number of years actually working to get this contract negotiated. What about it satisfies you the most? What are you most proud of?
Well, I think there's a few things. I think in the last contract in 05, we took a big hit on a number of provisions in that contract. Both we lost considerable institutional benefits such as official time and union space. And a lot of the employee rights and benefits were changed, we think, in an adverse manner. And I think in this negotiations, although it was long, tedious, and hard, we were able to regain many of those losses and also to improve some employee rights and benefits. I would say one key issue that that I think is extremely important and I always thought was one of the big issues of the contract was in the health and safety area where we had lost the right for the union to be on an equal footing with management when we do health and safety inspections. And now we've regained that. And I think that's exceedingly important that representatives of employees have a equal standing in terms of ensuring that the workplace is safe and healthy. I think on the benefits side, you know, improved transit subsidies and eyeglass program are certainly valuable to employees, especially in this environment that we have now where Congress seems to think that federal employees are overpaid and don't deserve the salaries and the benefits that they have. So I think achieving those goals, although they appear slight, I think they're very important in terms of saving employees money and especially when they're not getting pay raises. So I think that's also I'm proud of that accomplishment.
Vitold, let's shift gears for a minute and talk about some of these office closures that you're dealing with right now at SSA. Can you update us on that?
Yeah, interestingly enough, I just got a notice last night that the agency wanted to close our office in Rome, New York, and that is the 10th office closing that they've announced just this year. Last year, they announced 20 office closings. The commissioner asked Drew when he came in office in 07, started closing offices then. I believe he closed 17 in his first year. And we protested that at the time. Congressman Higgins from Buffalo, New York, introduced a bill which would have required the agency to establish criteria, which they currently don't have, for office closings. And that bill received a lot of support on the Hill. And the agency, although it didn't pass, the agency, I think it was a combination of our legislative efforts, the union's legislative efforts, and the Higgins bill, the agency asked Drew pulled back. Last year, he started doing the closings again. Now, ostensibly, it's to save money. But the problem is what they're doing is removing face-to-face service from many communities that currently, once the office closes, they don't have that option anymore. And we have these horrible situations where, for instance, they want to, in Seattle, in Louisville, for example, they want to close community-based offices and send the employees over to a federal building, which is not accessible by all the people that we service, federal buildings, especially in those in Seattle and Louisville. You can't get in without a picture ID, and there's up to 20% of the clients that we service don't have that, so they can't get in the building. Therefore, they're denied face-to-face service. We service a population of senior citizens, and disabled people and the poor who file for SSI who have not the same access to computer technology or telephones than other citizens. ASTRU's pushing hard to fundamentally change the whole field structure of Social Security. He's pushing for us for Internet claims to be the primary methodology by which individuals communicate with the agency, file their claims, and deal with their business. Now, we don't dispute the fact that certainly there should be the option of filing on the Internet, but we've done three surveys in the last 3 years that show that a lot of people are losing benefits and making bad choices by filing their applications on the Internet. So when you close offices and remove face-to-face service, you basically leave Internet as the main option. And from our surveys of employees, the public's making some very bad choices. So this is a bad problem. Higgins has recently introduced another bill, H.R. 4086, that we're in favor of, which would provide for a moratorium on office closings and also require until the agency comes up with criteria for how they're going to consider office closing. Such criteria would have to include the impact of a closing on the community, the impact of a closing on the workers who work in the office, and the impact of the closing on the administration. The bill would require public hearings to allow the community input into any proposed closing. So we think that's essential for the public to have a say-so in whether office is closed. The way they close offices now, it's basically at the last minute after they've made a decision to close, to notify the union and to notify Congress, the local congressman. They don't notify anyone else. They don't notify the press. They don't notify the community. They don't notify the local political structure, mayors, city councils, county government. They basically, people find out because there's a sign on the door, office closed. That's not right.
Vitold, you mentioned, obviously, that those who rely on these services are oftentimes elderly, disabled, or poor. What's the response from them on some of these initiatives?
Well, there's a lot of pushback. You know, when they find out about the office closings, a lot of people are upset. We now have a coalition of groups, for instance, in the Seattle situation, the two offices they're proposing to close and move the employees to the federal building in Seattle. The two offices have convenient parking. They're community-based. They have employees who relate to the people in the community. And the federal building has no parking per se. There's no is it difficult to get in the building? And we have a coalition of groups fighting that. The agency hasn't really given a good explanation of the need other than to save money. Certainly we understand the money savings, but, you know, in a program like Social Security, if we're going to have a Social Security program, and I think generally there's a consensus that there ought to be one, people are entitled to streamlined service. They're entitled to have the ability to communicate with an expert who can explain to them their options when they want to file a claim. They're entitled to a quick decision, and they're entitled to a check relatively expeditiously when they choose to file for benefits. What the agency's doing is inhibiting all those things from happening. Now, part of it's budget-driven, certainly, and we're fighting that. We've lost 7,000 staff in the last two fiscal years, and the FY13 budget has another 1,800 reduction, and we're fighting that too. But it seems to us that there are other cuts that can be made. There's a bloated management structure, for instance, within Social Security that ought to be looked at. We have mid-level management positions, which we feel with offices, 52 area director offices around the country, that none of them have been closed. Why concentrate on community-based service rather than unnecessary layers of management?
Vitold Skvirchinsky, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Vitold, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Federoff will discuss the federal budget deficit.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Carolyn Federoff, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Council 222. Carolyn, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Here we are today at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. You were part of the panel discussion today in front of the general session. Tell us a little bit about your presentation.
Well, my presentation is a visual demonstration of what cut only would do to our government. There's a big debate in our politics right now that we have to cut first. And when I went and looked at the budget numbers from FY11, I discovered that, in fact, if we were going to completely eliminate the budget gap last year, we would have had to eliminate every single piece of discretionary funding at the federal level, with the exception of about 75% of the Defense Department. So that means we would have eliminated all veterans' health, the entire EPA, all unemployment insurance. I mean, not just eliminating federal employees, but eliminating the entire federal program that those federal employees administer. It was devastating.
That's a fascinating study. Are you aware of anyone else who's actually looked at it so closely?
I'm not aware that anybody has looked at it the way I did it. I mean, this is all publicly available information. I just went to OMB's website and downloaded what did that agency spend in FY11.
If we were to cut first and cut only, you mentioned that services provided at the Veterans Administration, Environmental Protection Agency, all gone.
Yes.
What's the impact on service there?
I think the impact on service would be huge. I mean, we're also eliminating all the FDA food inspectors. We're eliminating all the Bureau of Prison guards. We would be eliminating all Border Patrol, eliminating the entire Department of Justice. In fact, in my budget numbers, I even eliminated the entire U.S. court system and Congress itself. And even with those numbers, we would still have to cut more than 25% of the defense budget.
This is something maybe that you would explain to someone who is an advocate for cuts, maybe even someone on Capitol Hill?
Absolutely. And in fact, what I intend to do is, this came about because the Boston Globe, my home newspaper, ran a poll, and they discovered that a third of Massachusetts residents believed that we could balance the federal budget by cuts only. And I thought to myself, wow, how would that work? And I started to look at the data, and I realized we have a long way to go. That if 30% of Massachusetts residents believe we can cut only, I'm willing to bet that 30% of AFGE members believe that we can cut only. And how could I create a visual demonstration that any local can use in their local meeting to demonstrate to their members that we can't get there by cutting government, we can't get there by gutting our government, that revenues have to be a fundamental part of our discussion?
So where do you think this misinformation has come from?
Two things. First of all, Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist has made it quite clear that he wants government to be so small that he can take it out and drown it in the bathtub. Clearly, this is a government that is small enough to take out and back and drown in a bathtub. And he will get his way as long as he can continue to enforce his no tax increase pledge. That is an absurdity. I don't think any real person, I don't even think the 1% wants dirty air, or that the 1% wants terror suspects not properly incarcerated, or that they don't want our borders patrolled. That there is nobody in their right mind, once you explain this to them, who would say, yes, that's the place that I want to live.
So let's talk about some of these potential cuts. We've seen them already being implemented along the way. You mentioned the Bureau of Prisons, Border Patrol, the entire Department of Justice, Food and Drug Administration, the USDA. Some of those cuts that those agencies are facing right now are very real.
Yes, they are. I mean, sequestration, there is an organization called Third Way, which has come out with some statistics on how many more cases of salmonella could we expect if sequestration were to go into effect. How many more cargo containers would come through uninspected if, in fact, those sequestration were to go into effect. The fact is, we need tax revenue. And part of this presentation, I remind people that in 2000, when President Clinton left office, I don't think any of us felt so overburdened by taxes that we would say, I'm not going to bother working overtime. Why, the marginal tax rates are so high, it's just not worthwhile to put in those extra overtime hours. Baloney. None of us felt overwhelmed by taxes in 2000. And that's what we're proposing. Let's go back to 2000.
How have budget cuts impacted your own agency?
This past year, they reduced community development block grants by 25%. But we have not reduced the total number of cities that are entitled to community development block grants. So a reduction in overall funding does not reduce the need for federal employees to oversee and monitor the use of those funds. We've reduced public housing capital needs funding by 25%, but we haven't reduced the number of public housing authorities. We haven't reduced the number of public housing units. What we've done is just deferred maintenance on the units that are out there. These are real cuts that will have real impacts on communities and on families that rely upon that housing. And more than 50% of public housing in this country is occupied by elderly families.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Carolyn Federoff, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development Council 222. Carolyn, talk for a little bit about how these cuts impact the community. And that's something that people may not really understand, is that this isn't just a spreadsheet. These are people's lives. These are people's neighborhoods.
I mean, people don't understand or are very unaware of the Community Development Block Grant, for example. That was a program that was established by President Nixon, a Republican administration, which took federal money and it made it available to cities and towns to use in low and moderate income neighborhoods. I am willing to bet that there is nobody listening to this radio program who has not directly benefited from CDBG grant funds, either because you got new sidewalks, you got better lighting, that your girls and boys clubs used it, that there's an after-school reading program, that there is an elder Meals on Wheels program in your community. These are funds that are available to the community to use for any purpose, provided that low and moderate income persons also are benefited by that program. It's an incredibly valuable program to the local level that really has helped build better communities.
Do you think that people who are advocating for cuts would be so passionate about it if they knew some of these specific items that you just mentioned about the things that, say, the Department of Housing and Urban Development do for the communities, if they knew more about some of the ways that these agencies helped neighborhoods, helped people?
I think that we have a lot of Americans who are insisting upon Cut First who really do not understand what programs are in their local community. And if they had a better understanding, they would think twice about it. But there is this real misperception that there's a ton of money that is put into foreign aid, that there is a lot of money in the budget for National Endowment for the Arts. And what my presentation does is it shows just how little money is in these programs that people like to vilify, and that if in fact we were to just rely upon cuts, these are programs that everybody knows somebody who's either in the veterans health system or somebody who eats meat and benefits from a USDA meat inspector, or an elder who lives in elderly housing. There is nobody who is not touched by a federal program.
And so where can people find your presentation?
They can find the presentation at our website, which is AFGEcouncil222.com. I am working with the General Counsel's office to make sure that there is also a version available that can be done on federal property. And definitely, I encourage people, take this, use it, present it in your own local. If you're a member of the PTA and you have an opportunity, use this or a portion of it at your local PTA meeting. If you are a member of a church or a civic organization, this can translate into that area so that more of our neighbors and our members and our families understand just how vicious the lie is that we should cut first.
As we mentioned, we are in the midst of AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference here in Washington. Members will be going to Capitol Hill to speak to their senators, their members of Congress. What are you hoping to achieve this week?
Well, for my own agency, part of what we're trying to achieve is to help our members of Congress understand the disproportionate impact that these proposed changes in pay and benefits would have on the ability of our agency to deliver services. Our agency went through about a 15-year period where we did very, very little hiring. So our employees are either very close to retirement age or they've only been in federal service for about 5 years. Now, those are two groups that are highly mobile. If you make working conditions bad, if you cut their pay, if you don't give them the opportunity for promotions or step increases, both of them can say, hey, I got greener pastures someplace else. And so what I hope to do is to convince our congressional delegations that if they care about delivering these programs, that these system-wide cuts will have a disproportionate impact on HUD.
Do you expect your representatives to be responsive to your requests and your concerns and take action?
Well, my representatives include some of the most terrific congressmen that we have. I'm going to do a shout-out for Congressman Keating, who is from Cape Cod in Massachusetts. He has a 100% labor record. And I had a chance to thank him personally last week. Congressman Capuano, Congressman Lynch, these are all real proponents for federal employees. Now, I also have Senator Scott Brown, and Senator Brown is a co-sponsor of the step increase and a 5% reduction in staffing in order to protect defense budgets. So my hope is that I can say thank you to our real champions, and I can impress upon our detractors, such as Senator Brown, that we are watching closely, and that if he insists upon having federal employees bear the brunt of deficit reduction, that we will insist upon him bearing the brunt of our activism against his reelection in 2012.
Carolyn Fedoroff, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development Council 222. Carolyn, thanks for coming back on the program.
Thank you so much, Jason. Glad to be here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Environmental Protection Agency, Council 238, Executive Vice President Tom Link will update listeners on the Council's Save the Environment, Save the EPA campaign.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Tom Link, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Environmental Protection Agency, Council 238. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason. It's always great to be back here talking with you.
The EPA Council's top agenda right now is your campaign, Save the Environment, Save the EPA. Tell us about the campaign and where it stands today.
Sure. When we were at our training conference this past summer, we saw a piece of information from AFGE National, which was called Save the VA, Veterans Administration. So we took a look at that and thought, wow, this is a really interesting concept for us at the EPA to let the American public, to let our bargaining unit employees know that there is trouble in terms of funding the EPA. And if we can't fund the EPA, we can't protect the environment. And if we can't fund the EPA, our bargaining unit employees' jobs are at stake. So, for example, our budget was $10.1 billion in 2010, and the 2011 budget was $8.1 billion. So it's a huge reduction. So the Save the Environment, Save the EPA campaign is meant to get the word out there to the general public and to our bargaining unit. Make your voices heard in Congress.
How has the public responded to the campaign? What kind of reaction have you gotten to it?
We've had a great reaction to it, not only from the general public, but from non-governmental organizations like Sierra Club, Environmental Defense Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council. We've actually met with about 12 of them now, and they are absolutely excited that we're doing this. And we're working with them behind the scenes to get information to them. Because clean air and clean water is something that you can't buy. We were talking earlier about the people in Texas this past summer living in one of the wealthiest suburbs of Dallas, having to actually boil their water. So it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic strata is. Environmental protection is important.
Do you think situations like the one you mentioned in Texas are examples of a good wake-up call for people to understand the importance of keeping the air clean, keeping our water clean, saving our environment?
It should be a wake-up call. All too soon, people forget. I mean, after the crisis is over and think, well, this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It'll never again happen to me. But the fact of the matter is, it's happening all the time. As our infrastructure ages, everybody's concerned about bridges and roads and sewage treatment plants and water plants. That's one of the things that we're trying to highlight in these visits this week here while we're at the Legislative Action Conference.
Are you finding that your fellow union members within AFGE from other agencies are getting on board with the campaign?
We would love for them to get on board with the campaign. It's very simple. You do not have to work at EPA to be a part of Save the Environment. We'd love to welcome our Social Security brothers and sisters and IRS, and to go to our website, savetheepa.com, SAVETHEEPA.com, to learn all about what we're doing. We think it's also a great way to boost membership. We're finding that a lot of our bargaining unit employees who aren't members are saying, now this is a plan I can get behind.
Now, earlier you had mentioned some of the funding levels that the agency has received in the past. Talk about how funding directly correlates to public service.
Well, what it actually directly correlates to is public health. We estimate in our studies that going from $10.1 billion to $8.1 billion will cause an additional 220,000 premature deaths this year alone. And those deaths are from infant mortality, from elderly. What we're looking at is the at-risk groups, environmental justice groups, people that don't live in the best part of town.
Today marks the beginning of AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference, where nearly 1,000 AFGE members from around the country have come to Washington to take to Capitol Hill to spread their messages to their members of Congress and their senators. What are you expecting to get out of the week?
We're expecting to get a lot of blank stares, unfortunately, from some of our legislators in the House, but we are an equal opportunity employer, and we go and see both sides of the aisles. So Council 238 represents 10,000 EPA employees across America at 14 AFGE locals. So we have 24 people here in Washington this week on the ground, more than 60 appointments from Monday through Wednesday, half of which are the Democrats, half are Republicans, and we're trying to meet with every House committee chair that affects the EPA. So we're gonna have some hard talking, some tough talking.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Tom Link, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's EPA Council 238. Tom, your council is no stranger to Capitol Hill. In fact, over the summertime, you usually come in and you bring your members in for another trek up to Capitol Hill. How important is it for you and your council to be involved in the political process?
It's very important for us to be in this process. And yes, every year now for the past 3 years when we have our national training conference, it's George Meany Labor College in Silver Spring. One of those days is devoted to our day on the Hill, where we come in and have a Senate breakfast in the morning and invite senators and congressmen to make remarks for the press. And then we set up 30 or 40 appointments in the afternoon, much like this one, just to keep our issues fresh in our representatives' minds. And so when we come back this week, they recognize us. They call us by name when we walk in their office, even if they don't like us.
Does that make you feel good just to know that they are at least listening to your concerns and receptive to some of the things that you're talking about, both sides of the aisle?
It's what you have to do. I mean, you have to make the effort no matter who you're talking to and make sure that you get your issues across. Clean air and clean water and reduced toxics in our environment is something that everybody should be concerned about. After all, I mean, Mother Earth is our only one, right?
You have a unique perspective on that Mother Earth. You probably have a little bit more knowledge and information about some of the things that are in our environment. Do you think people would be surprised to learn some of the harmful things out there, some of the toxins that you mentioned? And if they learned more about those things, do you think they'd be more receptive to some of the initiatives that you are undertaking?
That is a great point. For example, when you go to fill up your tank for your car at a gasoline station, you've probably noticed the odor, which is VOCs, which is benzene in a lot of cases. Benzene is the only proven carcinogen out of all of the toxics so far that EPA can say absolutely causes cancer. So here's something to do. When you fill up your next tank of gas, don't breathe the vapors. Stand on the other side of the wind. Stay out of those benzene vapors.
That is a really interesting point, and I'm sure not many people knew that. In fact, sometimes that smell, people, it's distinct, and they purposefully smell it.
The other thing is, in the summertime, it's especially bad on a 99-degree day, and your kids are hanging out of the van's windows while you're gassing up. Don't let them do that. Kids are, you know, one of the at-risk populations. Their bodies are smaller. They absorb more toxics.
You're based out of Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. What brought you to federal service?
What brought me to federal service was I joined the EPA in 1973 when the agency was 3 years old. We just celebrated our 40th anniversary. In 1973, it was the Wild West. Everybody, well, President Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. George Bush Sr. Enacted the Clean Air Act of 1990. We've had some prominent Republicans that have cared. And in those days, it was pretty much whatever you can think of to protect the environment was a go. And like I said, I've had a lot of different jobs there, and I feel very fortunate to have had a federal job that may have helped somebody somewhere else.
And what then ultimately brought you to the labor movement after joining EPA?
Later in my career, I noticed a number of issues that were facing older workers at the agency. And it's not just EPA, it's all over. Lack of opportunities for advancement, things like that. And I wanted to provide a voice for those people that were early in their careers, afraid of speaking up, had questions about scientific integrity. That's one of our big issues at EPA is letting the scientists actually talk to the press. We've had a number of employees that have been fired for doing so. So my job is to be an advocate and a spokesman and be the go-between between the employee and management in those sorts of scenarios.
How important is it for workers to have a voice in the workplace?
It's crucial for workers to have a voice in the workplace. Without a union representing you and looking out for your interests, how can you be sure of what the truth is that you're being told? How can you be sure that the numbers that the people you work for are valid? So our motto is, like many people's mottos, is question authority.
How does it make you feel personally to hear these attacks on federal employees?
You know, it hurts. It hurts tremendously. When I joined the federal government, we had the civil service system, and I took an oath where I actually put my hand on a Bible and swore to uphold the Constitution, and I took it seriously. It was a little bit scary, as a matter of fact, but you know, civil service is one of the greatest things you can do, is to serve other people in America. As a matter of fact, what a lot of people don't know is the caption "close enough for government work" in the early days actually meant a very good thing. Close enough for government work meant that government specifications were so tight that if it was close enough for government work, it was a great product. And we've lost that, and hopefully one day we can get that back.
What are you hoping to accomplish in 2012?
In 2012, I'm hoping to get our message out to our bargaining unit, to the general public. You need to be involved. You need to not be a sheep. You need to start thinking for yourself. You need to start asking questions about basic things like, who is protecting my water? Who is protecting my air? Who are the federal employees that I need performing services for me, rather than just taking it for granted?
Tom Link, Executive Vice President of AFGE's EPA Council 238. Tom, thank you for your time and best of luck this year.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski, Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Fedoroff, and Environmental Protection Agency Council 238 Executive Vice President Tom Link. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening.